We've got Trump and the Jews, a new Chinese social credit announcement, a interesting new wrinkle and conspiracy theory concerning the 2016 presidential elections, and a full breakdown of the Plan for Peace, Plan to Take Your Guns, by yours truly, on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They are the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men of this country, just shut up, do the right thing. For a change.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. This is Scott DeCosenza coming at you with Tim Donner in studio for at least a portion of our podcast. Now that we're on video, we have to specify these things.
I love the DJ thing, the coming at you thing. I mean, I feel like that's like a 1970s DJ thing. Hey, Scott Cosenza, coming at you.
Yeah. It would be a little more smoky, I think.
You got to do a talk up right to the first lyric of the
song. That's right.
You have to do that,
then
you do the 70s
thing. Then
you
get the smoke break outside, right?
Absolutely, of course.
Well,
actually, in those days, when I was in radio, I just smoked right in the studio.
Oh, of course, yeah.
You know, just smoke right in the studio.
Yeah.
It was probably
an ashtray built right into the monitor.
Pretty much. Yeah. If there wasn't, there were like seven backups under the counter. The room that I was in was probably 6 feet by 8 feet, and I just smoked right in there. No, you know, now you couldn't even smoke on the same block.
Speaking
the same
of
city
smoking,
block.
Tim, why don't we launch right into it, and let's talk about Eric Garner and his killer and the five-year wait time for Daniel Pantaleo to be fired from the New York City Police Department for unlawfully killing Mr. Garner, right?
Well, there had to be a scapegoat, didn't there?
And
Somebody had to pay the price. It wasn't going to be the mayor or the police chief.
Former longtime New York City resident, by the way, Tim Donner.
That's correct. Though I never had the privilege of living under the administration of Mayor William de Blasio.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I did live through John Lindsay. Lived to tell about it, too. He was one of the worst mayors in the history of America.
I thought Dinkins was the worst.
Dinkins then challenged Lindsay.
Did he succeed?
Dinkins challenged.
Does he own the title?
I think it's, I tell you, it's six of one, half dozen of another. You could say Dinkins picked up more problems than Lindsay had when he came into office. Mm-hmm. But Lindsay, you know, Lindsay created problems.
Who was the better tennis player, I think, is really the important question, Tim.
I know John Lindsay couldn't have been in as good shape because you know that Mayor de Blasio does take a police detail and goes to work out.
Listen, he deserves it.
In his special Brooklyn workout center, it takes like 3 hours a day.
The people are counting on him. He's got a very high-stress job.
That's
How
true.
Dare you?
Will you forgive me? I don't know. I'm not myself today, Scott.
So it's infuriating that it takes 5 years to fire a guy who violated the law and put an illegal chokehold on a guy who died. I was listening to Democracy Now, actually, and they had one of Mr. Garner's daughters on the show to kind of remember him and talk about this ruling. And he had another daughter called, I think, Erica, who's dead. She had an asthma attack while giving birth. I think is the story. And that made me think, I wonder, does that shed some light on Eric Garner's health condition? Meaning, like, is there perhaps, you know, it's an issue with breathing and death, right?
Well,
so anyway,
he was, I mean, Eric Garner was, I don't know if you could use the word grotesquely obese, but he was
morbidly obese. Yeah.
And that contributes to a lot of things.
Yeah.
So we don't know. I mean, of course, the police department used that and originally tried to say that he sort of basically he died of natural causes.
Right, just,
I mean,
you know
it just happened
right
to have
ahead.
Been in a chokehold from five cops.
Yeah.
But again,
he could have been
we talked about this on the radio show. The issue is not even so much with the cops that did it, even though one of them got scapegoated after 5 years.
Yeah.
The issue is with the politicians on two counts. And I'm not the first one to make this argument. They're the ones that charge confiscatory taxes for people to smoke. So therefore, a lot of working folk can't afford to buy packs of cigarettes, or they're trying to get off cigarettes.
And maybe they'll do is it $12 for
more than that now?
A legal pack, by the way.
A legal pack, yeah.
So that's the other thing that they've done, by the way. Do you think what percentage of packs of cigarettes sold in Manhattan do you think bear a legit tax stamp? I bet you it is infinitesimally small.
Well, and then, of course, people go out of state and they buy and they bring it back. So it's counterproductive. Yeah. You charge that much in taxes, you're going to drive people. They can go to New Jersey. They can go to Connecticut.
You know who can't?
They can go to
the
Pennsylvania.
The poorest of people, by the
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
The people with the fewest resources. It always hits it's like the soda tax.
It's a classic regressive tax, meaning that it takes people who are already struggling and makes them struggle more because people in the lower socioeconomic classes smoke more than people that are rich.
Also, you can't just sell something on the side of the corner. In other words, you can't just say, hey, I'm selling coffee mugs. You just stand on the corner. You got to need a, you know.
But the politicians, the politicians created this, right, Scott? By creating such a high sin tax on cigarettes that a lot of people couldn't afford it. Then a lot of people are trying to quit, and maybe they'd like to buy one or two a day on the way home because it's like a treat, whatever it is. It created the market. The confiscatory rates of taxes created the market that Eric Garner
exploited.
Exploited.
Yeah.
Just like
I mean that in a neutral economic way.
Absolutely. And like a ticket scalper.
Yeah.
Who's just an entrepreneur of a different kind. Is it legal? No, it's not legal. But does that justify a chokehold? Of course not. But the other thing is,
entrepreneur is the right word. Who doesn't have any overhead? They don't have the infrastructure or the training to get through on a more sophisticated level of entrepreneurship.
He makes it up in volume, Scott.
But still exists in civil society. He's not threatening anyone to buy his cigarettes. If you want to buy a cigarette from him, he'll sell you one. And that's it.
Is this not the American way?
Yes.
Entrepreneurialism. But the other part of it. And in addition to passing high taxes, is the pressure that are put on the police to make the punishment not fit the crime.
Yeah.
Make the punishment be that you have a zero tolerance policy, which means you take a guy who's selling a loose cigarette. I mean, just the concept of it. He's selling a loose cigarette or a bunch of them, and five cops bring him into a chokehold. That's because of the pressure that's put on the cops. I'm not saying the cops were blameless, but the pressure was on them to be severe with likes of Eric Garner.
Let's dial it back even one notch. The severe pressure on them to produce stats. So they have that monthly report. How many people did you interact with? How many tickets did you write? How many arrests did you make? And you, just like some profit-making corporation, they're pressured to have good stats and to improve on their stats. And this was Adrian Schoolhouse is the name of the former New York City police officer who recorded his sergeant at roll call, basically telling him to just go out and, you know, don't go and be a police officer and look for problems in society. Go focus on anything to get that particular stat. And that's the interaction. And then you combine that with a zero tolerance policy by the police for people that do not respect what they're doing. Okay. That's another component of this. Eric Garner, he had contempt for those police officers. I don't think that was misplaced contempt, by the way. But that also is a factor in his death, meaning he didn't submit, quickly and completely like I think he would have if he thought they mistaked him for somebody who had robbed a bank around the corner, because there's no trust in law enforcement that's the kind of crime they are investigating, that they're really out there trying to help people or put away bad people.
And the thing that galls me about this is that the left wants to make this an issue of racism. And it really isn't an issue of racism. It's an issue of the police receiving an edict from the politicians that they're to be tough on crime, and they're and it's an extension of the Giuliani thing, which worked, by the way, which is the rule, the law. It worked for the for what he wanted to achieve, Scott.
I don't have the stats in front of me now to call you mistaken on that, but you're talking about the broken windows policing,
the
right?
The broken windows policing.
Even but Archie, look, the podcasting dog is upset about this kind of misuse of.
And he went to sit on the other side of the room. Good for you, Arch.
He's a pro-liberty dog.
He's renouncing what you just said in favor of mine. That's how it's to be translated.
It's your defense of their heavy-handed police tactics combined with the stop and frisk.
What I'm saying actually is that there are, you know, there's always unintended consequences of these kind of policies, and the goal of the policy was to reduce crime, but you get these residual effects, and you're also talking about a difference in administration between Giuliani back then and de Blasio now. I can't quantify that for you, but the point is that there's so much pressure on these cops to get exactly what you said, get the numbers, get the convictions. Look at the number of people we locked up that the district attorney can say when he runs for reelection. Is it not really just that simple?
We've got an existential crisis in this country with the relationship between the citizens and the police.
Yes.
And until the union contracts, and we talked about this on the radio show. In fact, I almost didn't bring it up because I was I think we'd already talked about it
on the radio show.
And it's the notion that that's why it takes to fire 5 years to fire somebody like this, potentially. I'm not saying that that's necessarily. And there's a likelihood that this man's going to get his job back. And when he gets it back, he'll, you know, they'll get back promotions and pay raises and back pay. And it's because not because the law, like New York State labor law or federal law require it, but because the private law of the contract that New York City signs with the police labor union, that requires it. And that's what happens in so many of these cases. There was a famous case, Tim, locally famous, when former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell was Philadelphia Mayor Ed Rendell.
Mm-hmm.
And a reporter was in the limo, like basically spending a day with him in his candidacy. Maybe it was his candidacy for governor. I can't remember, but they didn't respect the rule that what happens in the car is off record, okay, and went and reported. And what they reported on, it was a fascinating window, fly on a wall kind of a thing. There was a police officer, and I can't remember exactly what the malfeasance or obscene violation of somebody's rights were that this Philadelphia police officer committed, but the discussion was what to do about him. And basically the discussion was, well, go ahead and fire him. You'll get some heat from the union, but it won't matter anyway because the contract's written such that he'll just get rehired down the road with back pay and bonuses.
Right.
So unless we attack those union contracts. Now, by the way, I think the best course for freedom is there should be no contract, no unions for government employees. That is anathema to
no public unions, and famously even George Meany, founder, early pioneer in the labor movement, said public unions are of course not. We're not going to have public unions. FDR said public union, you can't have public unions. Now suddenly public unions are an entitlement. There's something we're supposed to live with. And look how
those
many
are the
of
only
these,
unions that are growing.
Look how many of these public unions are bankrupting states and municipal governments through their pension funds.
Public unions are the only unions that are thriving. These other unions are consolidating, and they're losing money hand over fist. Because why would you want to give
because they can't force people to get into their unions, and so more and more people don't want to get into the union. It's just about that simple, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Okay, moving along, Tim. I know that you have spent a significant amount of time as a high church official in your quest to worship Christ and his reign, and it sounds like, and we're going to get to your candidate Biden report later on in the show, but for now, this special report, as I understand it, Donald Trump has declared himself the King of Israel this week. I've just skimmed the headlines, but it seemed like that was the case.
He's a what they call an honorary king.
Honorary.
He's an honorary monarch of Israel.
Uh-huh.
But that comes from the comment that he should be king of Israel because the people in Israel love him so much.
Mm-hmm.
As he gets labeled an anti-Semite by the left here.
He may have to go run in Israel.
The left, which includes Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and the other open, flagrant anti-Semites, and they accuse Trump of being an anti-Semite. I mean, this is how ridiculous it's gotten. I mean, there's never been a better whether you like Israel or not, whether you think we support them too much or not, some people think we do, you can't argue that Trump is not basically the most pro-Israeli president we've ever had.
You seem to have missed the memo that he's the reincarnation of Hitler. So that's kind of at odds with being a friend to Jews and Israel.
I forgot about that.
He
made okay. So should we start with the Bill Maher thing?
Because you know more about the story than I do. I will say before we do start, though, not to get all Margaret Sanger on everybody, but aren't Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar Semitic as well?
No, it's true.
They are.
It's
right?
true. Yeah, no, it's Semitic actually true. People, they say anti-Semitic. So actually, a Muslim can't be anti-Semitic unless they're opposed to themselves. Technically,
well, no,
speaking.
They can be if they don't have the lineage from that area. Like you or I could convert to Islam, and we could be anti-Semitic.
But that's true. I don't want to. Not all Muslims are.
No, we want to celebrate anti-Semitism no matter which who it comes from. Right, go ahead. Let a thousand flowers bloom.
By the way, that was Scott D. Cosenza, Esquire. Direct all inquiries
address your letters.
And lawsuits to him, not me. I do not
write
consent.
Your complaint on the back of a $20 bill and mail it to please. So I actually I don't know what actually I read a headline about Maher saying something, so I don't know. You tell me what's the way to go.
Well, I'm gonna play you what he said. And you know, Bill Maher is a guy, he's a darling of the left, of course, and he's been bloviating on
the
TV show.
The man who donated $1 million to Barack Obama's reelection campaign, by the way.
His political action committee.
Yeah.
We don't want to say that he violated campaign finance laws by giving him
to the
Obama cause. Yes, and you always point out that he's a part owner of the Mets, so I might as well just get it out myself. Do you say Mets owner Bill Maher as if the 0.7% he owns makes him the owner? So now that we got that out of the way,
here we go.
So Bill Maher, he's a darling of the left. However, he sometimes lurches uncontrollably into a reasonable conclusion about certain things.
And he is a vigorous, now and forever, has been a vigorous defender of free speech.
He has been a defender of free speech.
He's actually a liberal more than a progressive.
He is more of a liberal. That's true. He's gone, you know, basically he's had his own degree of insanity induced by Donald Trump, but not
TDR.
I mean, in the context of things, his stuff is just mild. But this is what he said, and then we'll talk about what happened after he said it.
BDS is a bullshit purity test by people who want to appear woke but actually slept through history class.
Let me just preface this clip by saying what Bill Maher is referring to here is the so-called BDS movement, which
boycott,
is the
divest and sanction.
And sanction. Okay, which is something that the anti-Israeli faction, both in Congress and in the nonprofit sector, are supporting.
Let me interrupt and say this. There's a lot of controversy about whether it is anti-Israeli or a veil for anti-Semitism. There's a colorable case to be made that it's not about anti-Israel at all, and it is more about being anti-Semitic.
Well, now you're separating anti-Semitism from anti-Israeli, and that's something that needs to be parsed, because rightfully it's been said in the past, and when someone's criticized Israel and they said they hate Israel, when they're going, it's like are we not able to criticize Israel without being considered anti-Semitic? And in the past, frankly, there's been too much sensitivity to that. If we can criticize our policy towards Indonesia or the Philippines or North Korea or Russia or Spain,
certainly,
we should be able to criticize. But that said, Trump is the most pro-Israeli president ever. And Bill Maher, basically, he didn't have anything to do with Trump, but he's saying Here's what he said about the boycott, divest, sanction, the BDS movement.
BDS is a bull purity test by people who want to appear woke but actually slept through history class.
It's true.
It's predicated on this notion, I think it's very shallow thinking, that the Jews are in Israel mostly white and the Palestinians are browner, so they must be innocent and correct and the Jews must be wrong. As if the occupation came right out of the blue, that this completely peaceful people found themselves occupied. Forget about the infitadas and the suicide bombings and the rockets and how many wars.
Now that sounds like something Trump would say. Yeah. Almost. And Marr has always been on the case of Islam and the amount of terrorism
that
it's spawned and all that.
Yeah, I think. Yeah.
Well, but he's even more anti-Muslim, it seems, than he is anti-Christian.
Well, that's because, no, he, Sam Harris, and others who haven't lost their minds, they appropriately value the threat to Western values, to the Enlightenment, that Christians who believe, even like these New Earth ones that just science totally rejects their belief structure, they're not a threat to Enlightenment values unless they're saying we should be, what, beheading people who are atheists. Like, you can't go to Riyadh and say there's no such thing as God.
So this is what Marr is saying.
Yeah.
Marr has said, oh, well, Christians persecute too. He goes, no. No, it's not comparable at all. He's made one of the best arguments that I've heard, which is exactly what you just did. So the result was that the squad, in unison and through various formats, through statements, written statements, through social media, has said it's now time
media.
To boycott Bill Maher.
Right.
And boycott Bill Maher because he's not down with a cause, Scott. He's not really woke. And I think
you
that's
can't
what
have a
saying.
Toe in the water. Yeah. You are either all in
right.
or not.
I think Bill Maher is too much of a Joe Biden Democrat.
Too much of a liberal.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Liberals
an actual liberal.
Liberals get the bullet too. That's the saying, Tim. You cannot be liberal. You have to be for the speech restrictions where they, you know, where appropriate. And he's not.
Now, he's also Bill Maher, along with those of us on our side, willing to call out ridiculous political correctness on certain occasions, and I use that as a clever segue, into where the Democratic Party has gone. Now, we could play endless sound bites of the ridiculous proposals, right, and the Green New Deal and Medicare for All and all that. But really, isn't this all about identity politics and the quality or lack thereof of the candidates? And the message that they're, this socialist message that they're trying to get across, and the shame that the white candidates feel for being white in the Democratic Party, it all kind of comes together in this soundbite from Pocahontas going in front of actual Indians and saying after her famous DNA test.
I haven't heard the clip, but let me guess. Tim, she's not a member of an Indian tribe. Only tribes determine tribal membership.
Scott, she went much deeper than that this time.
Like anyone who's being honest with themselves, I know that I have made mistakes. I am sorry for harm I have caused.
I hate myself.
I have listened and I have learned a lot. And I am grateful for the many conversations that we've had together. It is a great honor to be able to partner with Indian country.
Partner
and
with Indian country.
That's what I've tried to do as a senator. And that's what I promise I will do as president of the United States of America.
Is Indian country?
I think
like
it might be politically incorrect.
Like that,
no, one of those stores with a big moccasin in front of it.
You start off 72 miles to Indian country, fireworks, popsicles, you know what I mean?
But that fawning apology just oozing with renunciation of her own white privilege.
One thing I learned about... watching one of these apology parades sometime this week on YouTube, you don't get to just apologize and then move on for something that you did wrong. You have to own that they don't say sin, but that transgression. You have to, that's for the rest of your life. You have to live in that apology state. You're in the fallen state, if we can use the religious terms. And there's no redemption from it. You're never saved from that fallen state.
Even if you had a race change operation to make yourself black, you're still at the heart of it. You are white, and therefore
you're a white supremacist.
You're irredeemable, Scott.
I don't know that you need an operation.
That's
now,
the word Hillary Clinton used.
Yes.
Irredeemable.
Yeah. Well, what do they use that for? And where is it heading? The notion that, you know, dividing people up by their races, and saying who can say what and who can't. I saw this, Tim, on Twitter, and I don't know if it's fair to say it shook me to my core, but it just sort of like the ghost of Christmas future. I happened to see this story about the Chinese social credit score and how 2.5 million quote unquote discredited entities is what China calls the human beings in China who are no longer able to buy a plane ticket. I don't know if you saw the video from Hong Kong this week of the elderly man strapped to a gurney and beaten by police officers for 20 minutes because of some offense he committed against the police. It wasn't that he was a pro-liberty protester, by the way. This incident happened, I think, some months ago. Just the video finally got out. It's just a notion that even in Hong Kong, okay, the police there running roughshod and rampant over the rights of the people. And this is an announcement that I'm going to play you, Tim, from a train. This is just a, you know, you take the Amtrak to New York for the whatever. This is the kind of announcement that happens in China on the train.
Dear passengers, people who travel without tickets or behave disorderly or smoke in public areas will be punished according to regulations, and the behavior will be recorded in the individual credit information system. To avoid any negative record of personal credit, please follow the relevant regulations and help with the orders on the train and at the station.
So, not only is this social credit system up and running, but right there, we're watching you, okay? That's the announcement.
Right.
Don't forget, we are looking at you.
You know what?
Mind yourself.
None of this should be surprising. This is a communist government, and we tend to forget about what communist governments are really like since the demise of the Soviet Union and the fact that North Korea is such a closed society. Well,
when they opened their economic systems, too, that caused some confusion in terms of it's a new way, right?
It's the most dangerous model in the world, Scott, because it says to a government, to a tyrant, if we give them economic freedom, we can do without giving them political freedom. They won't demand that. If we give them economic freedom, then we can continue to deprive them of political freedom. They've managed to make that work. But it, like you said, people are confused because we hear so much about the Chinese economy and their rates of growth, 6, 7% a year. It's slowing down now because of the tariffs, which are working to weaken their economy. And bring them to the table. When they'll do it, I don't know. But the point is, it's still communists running the Chinese government. They never stopped being communists. They just joined it with a capitalist model to make it into the most dangerous, because it says to other tyrants, if I can just give them bread and circuses, I can deprive them of basic rights, which we consider constitutional
rights. That's when they moved
on
Hong Kong
exactly.
This year.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you saw this statistic, but in the most recent protest, the mass protest in Hong Kong, I think it was the Victoria Park march, 20% of the population of Hong Kong was out in the streets, are the best estimates. That's how engaged they are for fighting for their freedom against the Communist Party of China, who are the ones who are controlling the opposition. You imagine 20% of Americans leaving their home and going for a march to demand liberty. It's breathtaking in its scope and scale, and their yearning to not live under the boot of those communist oppressors.
They asked Trump about this earlier this week, and he dropped the T word, Tiananmen Square.
Yeah.
He said, if there's another Tiananmen, they asked him, and it's a good question.
Right.
What would happen to your negotiations with China, with the president for life, Xi Jinping? Mm-hmm. What would happen if they cracked down on the demonstrators in Hong Kong to a degree where the world is up in arms about it? And, you know, he said, if they pull another Tiananmen Square, then it would definitely have an impact on trade policy. But mm-hmm. the point is that he mentioned the T word, Tiananmen
that
Square,
alone,
because that's the danger.
For people who don't know, China is so guarded with their own, you know, we wear our warts on our sleeve, right? Some commission with a public document that you can read about the rights that were violated after
they
it's done.
They have none of that in China.
It's the exact opposite.
Right.
And even to say the words Tiananmen Square is pretty bold, I think, diplomatically speaking.
I think, though, that we're really on to something here, that people see that China is a competitor of the U.S. in the world economy, and they don't think of them as being communist. But this kind of stuff proves that you need to remember who, at their core, the rulers of China really are.
They're all about the power, and they'll do whatever they can to, you know, they just decided they get to be even more powerful and even richer in power. In other words, the standard of living of you know, the commissars in Beijing is way better than it would have been in Moscow with their closed economic system. You know, they have all these luxury goods that they don't have to invent excuses for.
Well, I was able to get to Hong Kong about 3 years before the, maybe 4 years, before mm-hmm. the turnover occurred. And people were already pretty much shaking in their boots about what was going to happen because it was under British control until 1999.
I remember seeing television footage of the lines, to say around the block, almost around the island, to get into the British consulate for the last chance to get a British passport before mm-hmm. the swap in sovereignty.
It's a probably more orderly version of the flight from Saigon at the end of the yeah. of the end of the Vietnam War.
Yeah. All right, well,
with his lead prosecutor from Connecticut, and he goes through the details of what was actually done, because what I asked him in the interview, and you can hear the whole thing on the site, on LN, on libertynation.com, he goes through all the things, because I asked him, what do we know? Not what are we postulating or theorizing right. or assuming, but what do we know for fact right now about the origins of this surveillance of the Trump campaign, and then it carried over into his presidency. And I'll tell you, it's chilling. And nobody's going to stop Bill Barr, short of somebody trying to get him to resign or causing physical harm to him. He's intent. He is absolutely committed and focused on how this investigation began in the first place. And I'll tell you what, Brennan, Clapper, Comey, Strzok, Page, those people should be shaking in their boots
because
right
of what,
about
because
now.
Because of what we know, you're
yep.
saying.
Uh-huh. Oh, because of what we know.
Oh, and the latest, by the
and
way,
then the things
there's a
that
headline
we're
today
assuming.
That I haven't, because I'm working on prepping the show, I haven't had time to really get into the details of. There's a Judicial Watch hearing today about these redacted texts between Strzok and Page
right.
that are still being withheld by
right.
the Justice Department.
And why that is, they've never
yes.
given an adequate explanation
yeah.
as to why that is. But there's a lot of hell to pay,
yeah.
Scott. And, you know, the Inspector General report is going to be limited to the conduct of the Justice Department, right? Because he's an Inspector General of and for
mm-hmm.
the Justice Department. But the biggie's going to come when Barr is done with his investigation. And my question about it at this point only is, when does he do it?
What because, prison do we bury the Orr family under?
Yeah.
Nellie and Bruce?
Yeah, well, let me just say this. When does he do it? Or ask this question.
Yeah.
When does he do it? Because you've got
Three
an election coming
the election?
Up. Well, you know, that's true. I mean, but the point is, almost any time in 2020,
yeah.
if you think about it, it's going to be seen as a
yeah.
political act. Now
yeah.
it'll be seen anytime the left will call
yeah,
it political if he did it tomorrow.
Yeah.
But the point is,
he could do it the day after the election. They would
yeah.
somehow say that.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. But I think he has to do it this year, not next.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've been going back and forth a bit on topics this segment, which is fine. And I'm going to go bat another one in. And this is sort of goes back to the socialism versus individualism and freedom. And I just thought it was a really great quote from an unlikely source, another person who I disagree with politically often on many issues vehemently, but they seem to be more of a liberal than a progressive. And this is Piers Morgan on the Ben Shapiro show.
Populism is rising because liberals have become unbearable. And I speak as a liberal, okay? In my core, I'm probably more liberal than not. Although fundamentally, I see myself as a journalist and I'd like to see both sides of all these things. And I can argue both. But liberals have become utterly, pathetically illiberal. And it's a massive problem. What's the point in calling yourself a liberal if you don't allow anyone else to have a different view? You know, this snowflake culture that we now operate in, the victimhood culture, the, you know, everyone has to think a certain way, behave a certain way. Everyone has to, you know, have a bleeding heart and tell you 20 things that are wrong with them. And, you know, I just think it's all completely skewed to an environment where everyone's offended by everything. And no one's allowed to say a joke. If you said a joke 10 years ago that offended somebody, you can never host the Oscars, right? You know? So now there's no host for anything. The Emmys right. Now just said they're not going to have a host either. So hosts have gone. And soon every award winner will go because everyone's a human and they're all flawed. So no one can win awards anymore because there will be no platform before they even get on the podium. So then no hosts, no stars. Then no one can make any movies because we're all flawed. So no actors, right? So suddenly, where are we? The liberals get what they want, which is a humorless void where nothing happens, where no one dare do anything or laugh about anything or behave in any way that doesn't suit their rigid way of leading a life. No thanks.
Where's the diversity, right?
Three words, Scott. Conform or die.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was well stated by Piers, and I am going to break down, starting with an older Piers Morgan quote, the mess that is this giant new gun control proposal, but I'll do that solo. Tim, thank you so much for joining us on this edition of The Uprising.
Always a guilty pleasure.
Well, Tim likes to say that he is he's not a gun enthusiast, he's a Second Amendment enthusiast, something like that. Anyway, he's ironclad on the right to keep and bear arms, but I wouldn't go to him for shooting tips or how many grains to add to that cartridge to get the reloading power you need just right. So I'm going to handle the breakdown of David Hogg's attempt, along with his allies, to eliminate private gun ownership in the United States. And we had that clip of Piers Morgan and Ben Shapiro, and the previous when I heard there was an interesting Piers Morgan and Ben Shapiro clip, I thought it might have been the one from years ago when Shapiro really laid Morgan out on the issue of guns and gun violence. And they seem to have come full circle. They had a nice civil conversation on the Shapiro podcast. And I think that it is hopeful that Piers maybe has come around a little bit on this. And I think that Shapiro's message for Mr. Morgan is an important one. And it's an important message for me to have towards people who want to steal my guns and put me in a cage like Mr. Hogg. I think it's probably even more important for Mr. Hogg, because I seem to think that I've incorporated the message, whereas he and his gun grabber friends haven't. But here is Ben Shapiro on then Piers Morgan's CNN show.
On guns, my next guest has strong words for me. He says, I'm off the rails on guns in America. Ben Shapiro is editor-at-large at Breitbart.com and the author of Bullies, How a Less Culture of Fear and Intimidation Silences Americans. So why am I off the rails, Mr. Shapiro?
Honestly, Piers, you've kind of been a bully on this issue, because what you do, and I've seen it repeatedly on your show, I watch your show, and I've seen it repeatedly, what you tend to do is you tend to demonize people who differ from you politically by standing on the graves of the children of Sandy Hook, saying they don't seem to care enough about the dead kids. If they cared more about the dead kids, they would agree with you on policy. I think we can have a rational political conversation about balancing rights and risks and rewards of all of these different policies, but I don't think that what we need to do is demonize people on the other side as being unfeeling about what happened in Sandy Hook.
How dare you accuse me of standing on the graves of the children that died there? How dare you?
I've seen you do it repeatedly, Piers.
Like I say, how dare you?
Well, I mean, you can keep saying that, but you've done it repeatedly. What you do, and I've seen you do it on the program, is you keep saying to folks that if they disagree with you politically, then somehow this is a violation of what happened in Sandy Hook.
One of the chief things I think that it's important for anybody who makes a defense of the right to keep and bear arms is to not grant the notion that we're somehow asking for some kind of special permission to do that which injures children or supports violence in our society. The opposite is true. We hold the moral high ground. The right to defend oneself is a fundamental right, and it's especially important for gun rights. It's especially important that weak people, physically weak people, have the right to keep and bear arms. If you're a 98-pound weakling, what are you going to do if some people set upon you? Call the police? Well, you know, at the same time, it seems like the same groups who would have us be required to give up our guns are the same ones who are saying that the police don't police them well. I don't have a quarrel with them saying that they're not well policed. I seem to agree with them mostly. But then to say that we should be left defensive in the face of that and to their mercy, the mercy of the least of us, it seems crazy. So I think that the best way maybe to go about it is, instead of just sort of railing on additional gun control sort of broadside, I thought maybe, you know, this is an area of policy that I kind of generally know like the back of my hand because I've been paying attention to it in defiance of it, in opposition to it, since I was a teenager. That's when they started with the Brady Bill legislation and have been fighting against similar ever since. So I thought I would just go through very quickly, and I don't mean by abbreviating the cover. So I'm going to try to get all the points, and it is staggering how many points there are, how many different policy proposals they're asking for. But they're going on a full frontal attack. They want to make it terribly onerous for Americans to buy a firearm. They want to make it terribly onerous to be able to keep that firearm ongoing. They want to make it terribly onerous for any firearm company to make a firearm and any gun seller to sell a firearm. And then finally, on the ammunition side, to make that onerous and burdensome as well. And they probably haven't thought about it yet, so I hate to even mention it, but there's probably some kind of shooting range restriction in order to legally actually own the gun. But the nuts and bolts of it are a national gun licensing. So right now, there's no such thing as a federal license to buy a gun. If you don't know, if you want to buy a gun, what you have to do is comply with your state and local laws regarding buying, and federal local laws, but there's no license at the federal level. The federal gun laws basically are just a, if you don't meet one of the classes of prohibition, which is to say you're not a felon, for instance, you don't have a domestic violence order against you and so forth, then you may, and you're at a certain age, blah, 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 you may buy a gun. Different states may have different licensing requirements, from the abysmally strict and confiscatory like New York or California to the wide open like Nevada. I think Arizona is wide open and that sort of thing. So this would be an entire new body, a new federal license to own a gun with stringent background checks and training experience required not only to get that license, but to maintain it on an annual basis, along with the fees associated with it. So that would be the primary, you know, we can't have our rights dependent on taking a test to exercise them. The First Amendment couldn't have a literacy test or to make sure that you know what the hell you're talking about before you opine about something. No. Anybody's allowed to say what they want, and it's up to us, the listener, to decide. And the same thing is true with gun rights. If we required a test to exercise the right, well, then it's not a right at all. It's something less than a right, which, of course, Mr. Hogg and company would prefer it to be seen as legally. All right, so let's move along. The fees also are a bit of a stumbling block. You know, we have these people who say that it's an imposition, an impermissible imposition on the right to vote to require a driver's license, that the voter present a driver's license in part because of the cost involved in obtaining that license. Well, if the $13 or $27 driver's license cost is a barrier to exercising the voting franchise, what about these hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of dollars of licensing fees that are going to be required to own a gun federally? Again, that's a bug
for me and gun owners and liberty activists or people who care about the ability to exercise the right, but it's a feature for the gun grabber, because what it means is that a massively fewer people will go ahead and choose to keep and bear arms and exercise that right. So let's move along. Assault weapons ban, the nuts and bolts of it are not exactly laid out, but smart money bet is it's going to be written broadly enough to encompass any gun sale, or rather any rifle, modern rifle with a center fire rifle. The AR-15 is their chief bugaboo, but their chief enemy. But any rifle that is basically a modern semi-automatic center fire rifle will be banned. It's funny how, you know, they used to leave rifles alone when I was a kid, and then handguns were the great enemy. But now it's rifles, and you get to keep your handgun, I guess. 10-day waiting periods for each gun purchase, which is, we've had that before. It's an imposition, and I believe it's unconstitutional, but I don't think it's going to crush rights. Raising of the legal age to buy a gun, a limit of one gun per month, a prohibition on any and all firearm and ammunition sale or transfers online, including gun parts. Now, the thing that's crazy is, you know, there are parts to I'm holding a little binder clip in my hand. There are parts to guns that are about as have as much plastic in them as this and weigh as much. And they don't even necessarily have anything to do with the functioning of a firearm. Maybe part of the functioning of getting the grip to stay in place or something like that. Why would you ban the sale or transfer of that online? Why can anything be banned online that can take place in person? That doesn't make any sense. But of course, I don't think this is about rationality. It seems to be more about doing something and doing many things. Storing standards, requirement to safely store firearms, including implementing national standards for a locking device or locking devices, requirement that guns are reported as lost or stolen, which of all the things, that's perhaps the least objectionable. Also, there's a magazine ban. Anything, I think they don't specify that it's 10 rounds, but that's what all these ones do. So it'd be shocking if it wasn't 10 rounds. The problem is that there are many magazines that are what we call full capacity, not high capacity, which is to say, they are just the standard capacity, like not something extra that's strapped on, but the one that the gun designer just designed in, not anticipate any kind of ban or anything. It's just, the thing is, it's not going to lead to any safety benefit. For those of you that understand cars, it would be like if there was a campaign to shut down speeding, or there were a lot of criminal speeding going on. And so they said, well, most of these people have got these big cars with 12-cylinder engines. So we're going to ban 12-cylinder engine cars. And the people who own the 12-cylinder engine cars would say, you know, you could ban my car, but I'm not the one who sped. And the people who do the speed, they're just going to buy another car. And there are plenty of 8, 6, and even 4-cylinder cars that can go like hell. So it's fruitless. That's the idea. There's a extreme risk protection order component, which I think we've gone over before, is a massive problem with respect to a person being able to have their rights violated or removed without due process of law. That's sort of the par for the course for these extreme risk protection orders. You don't get the chance to defend yourself in court. Then there's the National Gun Buyback, which is, of course, horrible language because the federal government never owned those guns in the first place, so they can't buy them back. But this is really a national confiscation program. So the nice thing about it, if you want to say it that way, it includes that the gun owners should be compensated for their having their guns taken against their will. So it's something less than, I guess, a true theft. But in any case, it's a taking. And it goes further than that, which is to say that it also asks for, or doesn't ask, it requires that there be a large pool of taxpayer dollars made available to buy any gun that any American wants to go ahead and sell to the government. The idea of reducing the overall inventory of guns in the populace writ large. So another thing is just an encouragement in the plan that states further restrict gun rights beyond what the plan offers, which is breathtaking if there is such a thing as a Second Amendment, that the states would be encouraged to actually go further in violating it than the feds. But that's from the perspective of somebody who believes in that the Second Amendment actually means that individuals get to keep and bear arms. The other thing is a direction of all these federal agencies to basically go after gun manufacturers, more money for studies and empowering of agencies, the appointment of a, they don't call it a gun czar, it's an, actually it's the National Director of Gun Violence Prevention. That person is in charge of basically making sure the agencies coordinate to take the guns away more effectively and efficiently. Then there's a creation of a, basically it's like a Peace Corps. The Peace Corps for Violence Prevention, known as Safety Corps, will put 10,000 young people to work per year. Anyone ages 26 to 25 would be eligible and paid a living wage. The unlock the power of young people to bolster the civic infrastructure of anti-poverty and criminal justice reform. They're going to send these kids into areas that have high violence and high shooting rates. It just seems absolutely crazy that that is somehow going to yield some kind of safety benefit. We know that so much of the violent the violence that we have, the gun violence that we have on our streets, are gang related and about the sale of narcotics and basically the arguing over turf for the sale, the real estate. How these kids are going to help, I don't know, but it's certainly going to be a massive transfer of wealth from the people who aren't on this government program. 10,000 young people to work on a living wage, which we know is not minimum wage. It's not 15, right? Was it $30 an hour? Is it 50? I can't even remember what the latest is. So those are the big things. Finally, they ask that the Second Amendment in the District of Heller case be reinterpreted by the Attorney General. It's not sure what that means because the Attorney General doesn't have anything to do with that ruling itself. But who does have to do with that ruling is the Supreme Court. And that is perhaps one of the scariest provisions, which is basically re-examine whether or not they should pack the court. It's when the Supreme Court doesn't do what you like, to say that we should just keep adding justices until it does do what you like, it seems to me a bit, what's the right word? It's not cheating in terms of the constitutional game. Cheating would be to say that the judges should actually just vote however they want without obeying the Constitution. But to just add justices, it just seems like a bad look. And also, why wouldn't then the other side just go ahead and add justices when they had control of the remotes? Doesn't that make any sense? I mean, we already have this escalating situation where there used to be an accommodation made for people on the other side of a given issue. And that accommodation was in the form of the many, many checks and balances that we had in both houses and especially in the Senate with the filibuster. And Harry Reid, you know, he decided that basically he was going to eliminate these protections against one party going ahead and do what they wanted without consultation to the minority party and the millions that the basically half at this point, half of America, the half of voting America that they represent. Well, then, of course, we're down the line now where if you just have 50 votes plus the vice president in the Senate, it seems like you can do whatever you want. Maybe the right thing to do is actually take less. Maybe the right thing to do is to try to inch our way back to a situation where there is more check and more balance, which means giving up some power. I have my own proposal of how that could work, which is that the Senate leaders on both sides could get together and say, okay, for the next Supreme Court nominee, we'll go back to needing 60 votes, regardless of whether that nominee comes up in the Trump administration in his serving out his current term or in a Trump administration part two, or a Democrat administration. So no matter who the next justice is, and then an agreement that the consent on that justice will not be unreasonably withheld by the other side. And then if they negotiate in good faith and go forward, we can return to where one side doesn't get to keep all the marbles, because what that leads to is chaos and worse. So I would say to Mr. Hogg, the plan for peace, the problem with the plan for peace is the massive, massive amount of violence that it will unleash in the United States, because people are not going to go ahead and have their rights stripped from them and their guns taken from them. Those gun confiscations are going to result in the deaths of many Americans. And I'm not under any delusion that the federal authorities, and I'm sure that the local police and state authorities who go to confiscate these people's property are going to somehow be the on the losing side of that. I think that it's probably going to be the citizens that are on the losing side. They don't have the training, the unlimited budgets, and the equipment like the state, armed people do. But that doesn't mean they're not going to stand up for themselves. I think in somewhat large numbers, to the point where if Mr. Hogg really wants to see fewer gun deaths, what he should do is abandon this plan, because it seems like it will just create a massive, massive amount more. All right. That's about it. Thank you for Tim for joining me. Thank you, Archie the dog, who he did make it to this part of the podcast. He's just he's off camera somewhere. And that's all the time we have. Please like, comment, and subscribe, all the good stuff. And catch us next week on The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com, your source for conservatarian news and analysis 24/7, 365. Bye-bye.